My battery is low, and it's getting dark. Welcome to Steamcast, where STEM and the arts collide. I'm your host, Dan Kostelic, and together we're going to have conversations with the brightest lights and rising stars in the fields of science, technology, engineering, the arts, and math, exploring the world that we live in, the science that makes it all possible, and the art that makes it interesting. This is episode 7, where I welcome back research scientist Nathan McDonald. We have a wide-ranging conversation going from the concept of discovery to the future of space travel, ethics in scientific research, and saying goodbye to the Mars Opportunity Rover, or OPI. She was only intended to have a functional life of 3 months, but she was on a mission of exploration for nearly 15 years. NASA confirmed a total loss of contact with her last week on February 13, 2019. We talk about what she has meant to expanding our knowledge of the final frontier, and how losing her may have helped to reignite the world's appetite for space travel.
So you were talking about, just a moment ago, Google Earth.
Yeah. We have this Google Earth, and most people just use it to just find an address. I want to go to a new place I've never been before. I want to get a screenshot, see what I'm looking at. But you realize you can look at absolutely anywhere in the world that you ever wanted to. And three, Alaska, Siberia, and Antarctica. You zoom in on some, just zoom in as absolutely far as you possibly can, and you realize that you're looking at trees that, quite frankly, possibly nobody else has ever seen and never will see again, just because you're zooming in on just one particular place. Just how weird and how cool that is to really think about. But I think that's amazing, just to sit and scroll.
I've never zoomed in on Siberia. I like to go in on just, places I guess everybody's been.
Okay.
Disney World, for instance. There were urban legends for a good long time that you couldn't get any aerial photos of Lake Buena Vista, which is the Disney property in Florida, that somehow, I guess, Walt Disney himself back in the day or the Disney company had paid the FAA or whomever or made some deal to no flyovers.
Oh.
Ever. And so it was like, oh, well, you're never going to hear a plane. I was just down there last year. You heard planes.
Okay.
It was not a constant thing, but every once in a while you'd hear one or you'd see one. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, that was totally not true. Or if it was, it's long since over. But I like to zoom in on the Magic Kingdom. And then using the street view.
Yeah.
Inside, like zoom in and then switch to street view and then just see what people have done. And I guess they've allowed Google themselves to come in.
Oh, really?
And go around because, oh, yeah, okay. It's amazing. Because you can just go under the Epcot Dome in Google Maps.
Oh, wow.
Now. Oh, it's
okay.
Amazing. I love it. It is one of the nerdiest things I like to do. So instead of going where no man has gone before, I go where every 12-year-old has gone before. I'm like, yeah, I need to see this.
But to me, it goes back to the concept of exploration.
Yeah.
I want to see things either nobody's seen before or very few people have seen before.
Sure.
Right now, I'm on a big kick on Soviet space exploration and Antarctic exploration.
Okay.
The heroic age of Antarctic exploration. And you realize at the turn of the century, most of Antarctica was an empty space. Nobody knew what that was. And how many expeditions went out to just try to map it, just to map what's the next hill? Can we identify on one side of the continent the mountain we saw on the other side of the continent? Related to that, couldn't get up my hill the other day. Okay, I live on a steep hill. If it's snow, if the snowplow does not go through, I cannot get up my hill type thing. Drive, I can't. I had to park at City Hall and walk half hour or whatever in the snow, in the dark, in the cold to my house. Suddenly that mile feels a whole lot longer. And you really start to appreciate the terrain, the geography. And I drive it every day, but I suddenly have to pay attention to and care about, well, that tree and that stone and, you know, that gradient. You start to appreciate the landscape a whole lot more when you just have to walk somewhere. And I think that kind of gets lost in America by virtue of we drive around everywhere. And so by proxy, being able to zoom into Siberia, zoom into Alaska, and care about that mountain is next to that mountain. How far away is that? know, nerds care about maps anymore. Yeah, I don't know.
I think it's the same overall caring about the individual details, though, that takes me over to let's zoom in on the Magic Kingdom, or let's zoom in on London or New York, because noticing things that I have never seen or that I personally have not gotten to or maybe will never get a chance to go see. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to go to London. So I'd like to zoom in on stuff that I've read about and then seeing it in life in a type of context that you don't get in a magazine or on a TV show or even just on an internet image search. It's really cool seeing like the guards outside of Buckingham Palace, the changing of the guard happening, but it's a camera shot of mid-action.
Ooh.
So it's a little blurry. It's a little messy maybe. Or there's a little kid in the shot, and it's the stuff that you don't see on TV or a movie. It's the perfect version of it, and it's
That's
not perfect.
That's a good point, yeah.
It's just fun seeing all the little details that you don't pick up or aren't shown to you in other cases.
Not shown.
Because they're imperfect, but the imperfections are the joy of it all.
It makes it human.
It's
a real place. It's a real city. There are people that actually move and go about and, you know, do whatever.
Yeah, I mean, if everything was as perfect as is sometimes presented to us, in that case, I think that would be the best argument that we're living in the Matrix. It's like, it's too good.
Street's too clean out here. Not enough people yelling at each other.
It's either that or you're in Toronto. Have you ever been to Toronto?
No, but I have friends that have, and they say the same thing.
Yeah, it's Toronto is the clean New York City. It's used so often as a stand-in for New York on TV shows and in movies. But then
Vancouver. I didn't know that.
But Toronto is also the dirty Vancouver.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, next time I get a chance to go to a conference in Vancouver, I'll take that opportunity.
And then you'll wonder, am I in the Matrix or is it just Canada?
Nice. I did really like Nova Scotia. Stayed there for a week. And Quebec. So again, exploration, went moose hunting in Quebec. Absolute middle of nowhere. Dirt roads, no satellite, or, you know, no GPS signal. We got there, it was dark, it was raining. It was like driving in those car commercials where you're driving over boulders and stuff through the woods. I mean, we had to cut a tree because it had fallen over the road. The truck in front of us, its taillights dipped into the water. It, you know, a stream had come up. A friend and a guy in front of us knocked over a boulder, driving up his truck, you know, foot wide, rolling down towards us as we're right behind it.
Oh my God.
It was absurd. Oh, we just kept waiting for this to end. I mean, we paid for this. This is serious. Now, what was great about humans can get used to everything, by the end of the week, after driving up and down this to go to where we were going, my father could drive with one hand holding Mountain Dew can and the other one, and you're just perfectly fine. And it was like, wow, I remember this was just the most absurd thing coming in. And by the end, it's another day, another day at the office.
Day one, hands are firmly at 10 and 2.
White knuckled.
Death grip.
We keep looking at each other. It's like, what did we sign up for?
Day five. I got this.
Exactly. Oh my gosh.
All of that brings us, I think, is a very nice natural progression into Mars Opportunity on a mission of exploration and discovery and curiosity. We're recording this on February 18th. Last week on February 13th is the last we apparently will hear from Opportunity. That seems to have affected a whole lot of people around the world. Why do you think that is?
First off, how long it's been. It was, what, 14-year mission?
Yeah, about.
That's what I calculated. When you look at the fast-paced world today, how many TV shows even last that long? For a lot of people, that's kind of, especially if they were nerds, into science, that's what they grew up with. And to see that finally end, kind of like the space shuttle ending. And I know the ISS will probably end, the International Space Station will probably end at some point, but I don't know if it has the same association. What's cool about, one of the interesting things, PR, if nothing else, the Curiosity looks cute.
The Opportunity, you mean?
So do a Lego robotics camp every year, mm-hmm. And we show lots of science and engineering videos. Every year we play this, it's called 7 Minutes of Terror. And it's a engineering video about the 7 minutes it takes to go from the top of the Martian atmosphere to land on Mars. And that was for the Curiosity rover, where they developed a sky crane to drop the robot onto the Martian surface. And I get goosebumps. I've seen this every year. I still get goosebumps as they talk about all the engineering steps, the heat shield. Then we're going to get a supersonic, a parachute. It's going to inflate. Then we're still going too fast. We're going to... rocket-propelled feet. We're going to... Just rockets to shoot the robot away from the parachute once they cut the parachute. And then it's got to have a computer sit and figure out where it needs to land and then drop and then lower the robot onto the Martian surface. All in 7 minutes, first go, and it's, you know, X million dollars to do it. And it's like, oh my gosh, people could do that. Isn't that amazing? Okay, so I'll go back to Opportunity. The look, what do I want to say about this?
I feel it looks vaguely Wall-E or Johnny Five.
Mm-hmm. So you get the personal attachment. It's not austere science. The real nerds can get really excited about the engineering, how its wheels work and the bearings and whatnot. But part of it is it wasn't just the temperature today is X. It's, I found a cool rock. Or here, look at this view. Look at this twister. We were looking at a comic about that the other day. It was really trying to get that air of exploration, the air of discovery, which gets into the curiosity, gets into the opportunity. This is something new. And this is something to be excited about. And how many people today just go out and look up rocks and think, this is bloody cool? Most people don't. This was a neat way to caught or to get people's attention. I hadn't really thought about the opportunity or about opportunity. That's not something that I grew up with.
Okay. So looking at Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and everything over the last week, seeing how the millennials have been reacting to it, the way that a lot of people react when you lose a big musician or an actor or just someone famous that has been like in your living room for decades, and kind of how when the whole world almost went into mourning when Robin Williams died.
Yeah.
It's like that, but crossed with, as you had mentioned earlier, the loss of the space shuttle. The final space shuttle launch went up and people were just openly weeping. It was a huge emotional moment. Not just because, wow, look at what we can do. We can slip free of the binds of Earth. But it's the last time we're going to do this.
It's the end of an era.
With Opportunity, I'm not sure if it's so much that end of an era or if it's closer to the anthropomorphizing of this little robot. It looked like Wall-E. And so many of these people, if not grew up on Wall-E, came of age when Wall-E was out there in the main portion of our pop culture consciousness. Here's this cute little robot who falls in love with another robot. So obviously it's our friend. You showed me the XKCD comics showing someone saying, how did it start? Oh yeah, lamenting about how everybody's looking at the world through their cameras and saying that's not necessarily a bad thing because it can show everyone else what's going on. So me looking at my phone might annoy person on the left, but then person on the right says, well, what are you looking at? Let's all see in exploration. And then the final panel was Opportunity, or Oppie, as they were calling her, guiding everybody through just her day or her adventure, saying, and that's my wheel track, and that's a really cool rock. And just, I feel like everybody feels like they've lost a friend. This is less science right now. It's more philosophy. And
well, that's kind of what I want to, I'm thinking and going through my mind. Like Bill Nye the Science Guy was rewatching some of his episodes. There's no math.
Yeah.
I think there was maybe one equation in one episode. It's a lot about the enjoyment in science. It's a lot about the excitement of science, and scientists, by and large, don't do a good job of that.
Yeah.
With the opportunity, you got to see a fun part of science again, and you had, again, the anthropomorphization of the robot, you know, Star Wars droids, with cool science. And so it became a personality, as you said. Really was the blending of the two. I think similar, maybe, for Bill Nye the Science Guy. And, you know, when eventually he passes, especially if you grew up with Bill Nye the Science
As
Guy.
As I did.
You know, I mean, that's what I tell people. If I end up destroying the world through my research, I blame Bill Nye the Science Guy for getting me into science and then Brant Waesaki for getting me into research. So you know who
he's not even in the room and you're still slamming Bryant. Well done. Bryant, you would be proud of Nathan right now.
But yeah, so I think that is a big part of it. Like a favorite teacher, you know, in second grade that showed you all the cool things, why scientists got into science in the first place. You know, it's for the professional scientists, well, if it was easy, it'd be boring, you know, type thing. You know, you want to work the really hard stuff. But for a lot of people, life is just interesting.
Yeah.
You know, the rocks are just interesting. And Mars is one of the last places you can still do exploring. That it's still unknown, I guess, if you will. I mean, sure, you can look at it, you know, you can look at a giant picture of Mars. But again, zooming into Siberia and Alaska, I'm certain that there is some place that you can zoom in on Mars, but how many people do that? And here you have something that is, however frequently it was tweeting, hey, look at this rock, and look how cool this is. There's something about that I think people innately enjoy.
For the zooming in, there is Google Mars now.
There's
Google Earth. There's Google Ocean, where you can...
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's been around for a little while now. And then there's Google Mars that you can zoom in on the topographical maps that NASA has been able to compile over the years with satellite imaging. And then from photos from Opportunity and Curiosity, just putting all of it together. Where does this go? Where does that go? So it's really, really neat. Off mic, right beforehand, you said to one extent it might feel like the end of the age of discovery because it was like the last little bits. Which, as you put, really ended around, you think, the
40s, somewhere in there.
Okay, that's where you
kind of mapped everything.
Okay. But what if this is the thing that actually gets us into a new one? You could say, to an extent, we had a burst of it in the 60s when we did the moonshot.
Yes.
But then... humans, I guess, being what we are, we all lost interest. And we're like, yeah, okay, we did that. I don't know why, but we did. But this one, it feels, especially with how the world reacted with sadness and malaise at the end of the space shuttle program, mm-hmm. because there was nothing directly following it. I mean, like, when the Saturn V's ended, you had this, we knew the space shuttle was coming. I mean, Saturn V ends on Tuesday, and then next Thursday, the space shuttle takes off. Yeah, we knew what they looked like. When we had seen illustrations and mock-ups of the first space shuttle Enterprise, not yet the Enterprise, when the Apollo program was ending. And it was like, okay, well, we know at the very least something is on the horizon. When the space shuttle program ended, we didn't have anything. We had SpaceX planes and things like that. It's like, okay, is that going to happen? But in the last couple of years, we've had almost like a reignition of that fire of imagination because Musk sent up his Tesla into space playing the Bowie song. That guy, by the way, is a Bond villain. Or at least he wants to be. He's going to be. He's just waiting for his opportunity. It's like something is going to happen, and then they have avant my Hyperloop on Mars. And then you need to send out James Bond and stop him.
And it'll get in some sort of math battle. You expect me to do coordinate substitution in my head? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. You know?
But instead of a straightforward way, it's going to be highly convoluted. You're going to have many opportunities to escape.
You've got me monologuing again.
Oh, we're just bringing in everything. Well done. Well done. We brought in the Incredibles, bringing it back to Disney. All right, so that got everybody reinterested.
Yes.
And, or at least really started feeding the fire and the fever, saying, hey, what can we do? Opportunity saying that her battery is getting low and it's getting dark. Oh my, I'm tearing up thinking about it. I think that might be the next step. 15 years of imaging coming back to us and slight editorializing, look at this cool rock, have primed the pump maybe. Sending the Tesla into space, playing David Bowie's Space Oddity, gets it going a little bit more. This could be the next step, saying, well, we don't have her anymore. We need to do another. We need to do more. We need to get out there. So is this going to, I don't see it accelerating our progress towards Mars or the rest of the solar system or the galaxy, but maybe getting more people interested? I don't know.
So, oh, there are a couple of different ways you can run with this. Early point, there is a big interest in space starting 1957 with Sputnik 1 launch.
Yes.
That really set everything going. And part of it was a looking to the future. They were looking at space would be the next evolution of mankind. You know, we were going to move to space and everything. I was reading a book, 1980s, on the space program, and they were predicting there'd be 1,000 people in space in a space station by 2000.
Yeah. Okay?
That fell off. And that era, 1970s, early 80s, they talk about the nostalgia for the future. There is a jaded, there is a cynicism that the technology didn't pan out. It would not be as easy as people thought. And when all the rest of the world's having trouble, who cares at some point? And so that's where you get the falling off. People were no longer interested. It became easy. Until Apollo 13 and then Challenger, it became a routine type thing. Which then gets into an earlier conversation you and I had about cynicism and skepticism with Elon Musk and NASA. When Bush wanted to go to the moon, oh, was it 2003? A while ago. People were kind of scoffing, and now they're like, well, yeah. You have the technology, I think, to be able to do that now. It's much more practical. And there have been enough technological innovations and demonstrations to say this is no longer a science fiction dream. And you're always going to have people that are going to try the new greatest, latest thing anyway.
Yeah.
But if you can do a demonstration that says this is no longer just obscure science, then you can get the general public's imagination going. And I think that's been why Musk succeeds and why NASA hasn't, is they, other than the curiosity and the opportunity and curiosities, that's been their way to drive public imagination. But that's not going to be enough to get the moon colony, the Mars colony. Combine that with the technological innovation. We can use reuse rockets and things like that. Now I think you have a winning combination. You've primed the pump, and now it's no longer a 30-year technology. It's, yeah, we could probably do this in the next 5-10 years if we really put our minds to this.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what gets people excited, is it's not a 50-year technology.
On that, when you hear the longer projections from NASA, which seem very realistic but not exciting, and then you hear the much closer, a lot more exciting, but also comes into the, yeah, you're not going to do it, projections from Musk and folks like him, who do you think wins? Is it the crazy optimism of Musk? Is it the pragmatic, we know what we're doing because this is what we do level from NASA? Or is it something in between? Because in 1957, the Soviets send Sputnik up. America loses its mind.
Yeah.
Because Russia now, for the moment, controls space. In 61, 62, Kennedy says, "We will put a man on the moon by the end of this decade. Not because it is easy, but because it is hard." And NASA said, "Okay, we got this." Now, NASA has always used outside contractors. Boeing has always been involved with NASA, as one example. So they have contractors. The contractors who are either creating something new for NASA or they already know what they're doing and they're making something to fit spec. So is it the private industry that drives it, or is it the government just putting its willpower behind it? What makes it happen?
So Musk and Bezos have been successful because it's their own money.
Yeah.
They tend to, and this gets into research is done differently from the government versus private industry versus academia. And that's fine. That's fair. That's proper. Private industry, man, they can go wild. They can do all the weird, crazy stuff. If you're doing government research, you tend to be, if you're DOD or you're looking at a Department of Defense, you're looking at military applications defense. If you're NSF and those sort of institutions, it's more general science. NASA, of course, it's going into space. For this type of application, you always get into trouble if you predict and whatnot. But
yeah.
I think Musk will win out only because if you get a leader with a weird enough idea that you can rally enough people behind it, then they just set the trajectory. And if you get enough people believing in that idea, they will come up with a solution. So there is something to be said for the kind of leader that you have. And how you lead a research organization is what we call an NP complete or NP hard problem. It's really, really hard to figure out what kind of leadership you need to do well in any given decade in any different research area for that research team to succeed. For this, I do think that the wilder, the better, if you can get the engineers and scientists behind it. And I think that Musk has done a good job with that. You do have to worry about safety to some degree, and whether both sides are guilty of this. Rushing to technology without fully understanding the consequences.
Yeah.
So I work in machine learning and whatnot, and we're very big on, before we deploy this silly thing, well, how can it... machine learning is very brittle. It's very easy to fool it. So before we start putting this into anything really, really complicated and where things can go wrong really, really badly, how do we validate that it's going to do its job correctly? How do we make certain that it can't be compromised? And in industries rush to push machine learning and Alexa and everything to the forefront, we don't always think about the consequences, and there is something to be said for an OSHA for science type thing. Let's stop and think about this. And I think the government does a good job with that. I'll put a big asterisk there.
Now we're going into a fun side tangent here of ethics in science. I could do 17 episodes with you. You're the new co-host of this show. We're just like, when we're not interviewing somebody, it's you and me just going, what about this?
So you're gonna get into trouble then.
Two questions.
Sure.
The first one is on ethics. You said like having an OSHA for science of like, okay, like maybe let's pump the brakes a little here. When is that important and when is that not important? Because sometimes you read about them just saying, well, we need unfettered science. Don't tell me what to research. Don't tell me what to do. Just let me go do my thing. And then you also get into the ethics of it, like, but should we be doing the thing? And then you have, again, another counter argument to that of, well, it's not a matter of should or shouldn't. It's like, it's going to happen. It is neither good nor bad. It is just science. It's just neutral there. Applications will determine whether it's for good or ill. And then on the other side, you said having a weird enough leader, somebody like who can get people interested. George W. Bush was a weird guy, and he had some crazy ideas, some big ideas, and he said, we're going to go to Mars. Was it just because so many people considered him kind of a joke at that point?
I think.
And that's why we didn't get behind it?
Yeah, unfortunately. Two ways that I think about this. One is ethics and one is safety, and you got to cover both. So I'm a lab manager. We joke about don't look at laser with remaining good eye. But I do have to care about, when we do experiments, what are the hazards of doing this kind of research? And you read about the scientist, the guy who discovered X-rays. He, he destroyed his hand by X-raying it too much. Madame Curie getting bone cancer, leukemia, mm-hmm. because of doing the radiation. When I worked in nanotechnology, you make nanoparticles. You have no idea if these are highly toxic or not. This is a new substance. So when you do science, there is an element of we don't know what we're doing and we don't know all the dangers. We have an idea, but there is a level of risk. So there is the real question, especially if you're a leader in science, what are the appropriate safety measures and when are you being reckless?
Okay.
Now, as far as ethics are concerned, technology is not morally agnostic. And I think we need to stop thinking about technology that way. And especially for the scientists and engineers. What is it, Facebook? Move fast and break things? That's not an ethical code.
Yeah.
Okay. I think as scientists and engineers, we focus on science, technology, or engineering and mathematics, but that doesn't tell you what technology to build, what technology not to build, how to use it, and how it might be abused. And I think that we do need to bring back the humanities. We do need to bring back a formal course in ethics.
Yeah.
What do we... And there's a difference between morals and ethics. Morals being your personal code of right and wrong. Ethics being societal. Societally enforced legal system, that sort of thing. From a research perspective, your own morals, what experiments are good and proper? And what experiments violate... I'm not phrasing this well. Go with machine learning, for example.
Okay.
We can collect lots of, and I'm not speaking myself, I'm talking about machine learning scientists in general. You can collect lots of data. Or what was it, Google's Don't Be Evil?
Yeah.
Collect lots of data. You can do lots of really cool things with that data. There are also ways, and I forget who said it, but something along the lines of, there's a creepy line and we want to get right up to it, but just not step over that line. You need to have a solid understanding in your own mind, what is that and when does that get crossed? And if it's not clear in your mind, by the time you realize where it is, you've already crossed it.
Yeah.
And I think that that needs to be, I don't know, more formalized among scientists, or at least it needs to be, because I haven't thought about this in a while, so now I'm trying to formulate a bunch of thoughts all at once. We'll bring in interns and I'll sit and mentor them, both in research. How do you read papers? How do you write papers? How do you do experiments and whatnot? But I also want to, I really sit and chat with them about morals and ethics. Because if they're going to be doing new novel research, whether we agree on where those lines are, I want them to have in their mind, where is that line?
Okay.
And I think that is very important. And not only where is that line, but have the spine to be able to tell somebody, I don't think that that is good and proper research. I don't think that's good and proper application. Because if you, what is it, the Milgram experiment. If you don't have that line clearly in your mind, then it is very easy to be influenced by others into crossing that line.
So is the Milgram experiment the one where the person would hit the button to put the electric shock onto somebody?
Yeah, that was, I'll say.
And the person would accept it because the person telling them to do it was wearing a lab coat or something like that.
Yeah, and that's scary to think about that when Milgram proposed the experiment, he thought, should I explain the experiment?
Yeah, go ahead, please, okay.
The Milgram experiment is a famous 1960s psychological experiment. So you'd bring in these people, and you'd bring two volunteers. One sat in the chair in one room, one went with the scientist in the other room, and it was a shock therapy memory exam. So the person in the chair would be doing a memory problem, and if they got the memory problem wrong, then the person in the other room would push the shock button. And the shock button panel would progressively get more powerful.
There's a jokey version of this in the original Ghostbusters, by the way. Go watch that, because that's just Bill Murray being a jerk.
Oh, that's fantastic. So anyway, with the hypothesis being that as we increase the shocks, it'd improve the memory and all that fun stuff. But it quickly escalated. And to the point that the last three shocks, there was a XXX, lethal, highly dangerous, mm-hmm. don't do this type thing. And as the experiment would go along, the person in the other room, which the person with the controls can't see, starts shouting out in pain, starts crying for the experiment to stop. And the scientists very calmly, they weren't shouting, they weren't threatening, just said the experiment has to continue. And when Milgram proposed this experiment, he thought that only 1 in 1,000 would go all the way to the end to deliver an end-up lethal shock. It turns out that over 66%, two-thirds of the people, delivered the lethal dose.
Oh, my God.
And do this in many different countries. It wasn't just Americans. And the question is, why? Why? And this is, and I tell this experiment because having good morals alone won't save you.
Yeah.
You need to, it needs to be something that is ever present in your mind. What is good? What is bad? What is morally right? What is morally wrong? And to question authority in that, in a constructive, way. And so what was encouraging in following examples, if there were two people in the room as volunteers pushing the button, if one was more hesitant, the other one didn't most of the time. If there were two scientists and they argued with each other, then the person pushing the buttons tended to not push the button more. So there are all sorts of subtle psychological things to improve the ability to not fall into this this trap.
So going into the whole concept of on a nuclear submarine, if you have the opportunity, or at least there's the potential need to fire the nuclear missiles, both the CO and the XO need to turn a missile key.
Yes.
So it can't just be one person doing it.
And this goes back to another point that that I'll often tell people is you need to have at least one friend that can tell you no.
Yeah.
And you'll listen. That you won't just blow them off. Because if nobody can tell you no, then you're dangerous.
Yes.
You know everything. So in research or just in life, do you have a best friend? Your spouse or somebody else that you can bounce ideas off of? You want somebody that can hold you accountable, and it helps you both ways. It helps you avoid the pitfalls that the Milgram experiment highlights. It is very easy to be manipulated if you don't know it. And then give you that accountability to help you, encourage you to do the morally hard action.
So wrapping up, talking about Mars Opportunity, NASA played a song. They played a song for her as a good night. What do you think of that?
That is really cool, actually. I would not have thought of that. And that's probably, as a scientist, I wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah, they played I'll Be Seeing You.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's just a really nice touch. Especially, as you said, especially with the reaction that people are having, it is a loss to a lot of people. And so I do think that's a very fitting touch.
In all the old familiar places.
That wraps up today's conversation on Steamcast. I'd like to thank once again Nathan McDonald for joining us all here today. Steamcast is a production of the Project Fibonacci Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit educational organization whose mission is to introduce our youth to a culture of interdisciplinary STEAM learning, teaching them to become creative, independent leaders of community resurgence. You can learn more by going to projectfibonacci.org. Steamcast was written, produced, and hosted by me, Dan Kostelic. You can follow me on Twitter, @DanKostelic. Technical support is by Andrew Berger. The music in the show is by The Live and Breathe from the album REIT. You can find it on iTunes or wherever you listen to music. Please subscribe and rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. On Facebook, we can be found at facebook.com/projectfibonacci. On Twitter, we're @profibonacci. That's PROFIBONACCI. Thanks for listening. Keep moving forward. Full steam ahead. And boldly go where no one has gone before.
In the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon. but I